This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the August 8th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. And every other fifth Wednesday, I want to open the phones to get your takes on the world. And now on to today's program. You rarely hear or read much about the war in Yemen these days, but as violence there continues to escalate, there are warnings by international aid agencies of a new cholera outbreak in the port city of Hodeidah, which is currently under a Saudi Arabia-United Arab Emirate blockade, backed to the fullest extent by the United States military. The Saudi and UAE jets that have been bombing Yemen since 2015 were purchased in the United States, but that wasn't the end of it. Their mid-air refueling, like their target selection, first authorized by President Obama, has been coordinated with U.S. military intelligence, ostensibly, we have been told, to reduce the number of civilian casualties, which, unlike the war in Syria, the media appears to have stopped counting when the number of dead was estimated to have reached 10,000. As new air attacks are launched on the city held by Yemeni Houthis, mistakenly characterized by the U.S. media as rebels, the aid organizations and human rights groups are worried about the fighting will turn what the U.N. has declared to be the world's worst humanitarian crisis into a far greater catastrophe. They warn of a second cholera epidemic and that more than 8 million Yemeni civilians are starvation. I'll be speaking on this subject at 20 minutes past the hour with renowned human rights activist Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and a recent article calling attention to America's ongoing support for the Saudi-UAE war crimes in Yemen. I have two more items on Yemen before moving on to related subjects. I mentioned earlier how the estimated numbers of dead in Yemen have stalled at 10,000. Last week, writing in the Washington Post from his base in Istanbul, Karim Fahim observed, quote, "There is no end in sight to the vicious war in Yemen, to the blood-soaked battles or careless airstrikes or waves of hunger and disease that stalk civilians even if they escape the bullets and the bombs. And yet the death toll seems to stand still. For 2 years," he writes, "a figure, 10,000 people, has been frequently cited by journalists and relief agencies to describe the number of civilians' deaths in the conflict. The number was based largely on reports from Yemen's crippled health network and first mentioned by a senior United Nations official in August 2016, 2 years ago. But in public discussion of the conflict," he notes, "the number has never been revised, even as the war has retained its ruthless intensity. It is almost certainly conservative and possibly grossly underestimated, according to UN officials and a now analyst who studied the conflict," writes Fahim, "with one independent estimate putting the total number of Yemenis killed in combat at nearly 50,000, end quote. Fahim suggests the nature of the fighting makes it difficult for both journalists and aid organizations to make estimates of the dead. This is no doubt true, but there is also, I suspect, another reason. It is that the United States government and the mainstream media have invariably followed Washington's agenda, believe that by keeping the death tolls low, the American public will ignore the war and the critical role that the United States has played in it, dating from President Obama's time in office. In Syria, we see the opposite, an escalation of the number of deaths, now estimated to be at 500,000, for which there is no independent confirmation apart from an outfit called the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. No doubt most of you have heard of it. What you probably don't know is that the so-called observatory consists of just one man, sitting presumably with computers and cell phones in the town of Coventry in the British Midlands, where he runs a clothing shop. That man, Osama Suleiman, under the name Rami Abdulrahman, claims to have been imprisoned 3 times for his activism against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Understandably, he has sided with the Syrian opposition since initiating his project back in 2006. In 2012, the German publication Süddeutsche Zeitung described the organization as a one-man operation with Osama its only permanent member. According to Media Lens, which monitors such things, Osama has received just under £200,000, roughly $260,000, to purchase cameras and communications equipment from the British Foreign Office, which also has been a major funder of the Syrian White Helmets, a number of whom had to be rescued by the Israelis and transported into Jordan 2 weeks ago to prevent them falling into Syrian government hands. On another critical Middle Eastern front, this past Monday saw the reimposition of harsh sanctions on Iran that had been lifted following Tehran's signing of the agreement with the U.S., U.K., France, China, Russia, and Germany to halt its nuclear enrichment program and the threat, quite openly by Washington, that the U.S. will once again apply secondary sanctions on any country or company that continues to do business with Iran. If President Trump is considered a bully by his domestic critics, consider that he may simply be the reflection of how the U.S. treats the world, be it longstanding allies, with the exception of Israel, of course, or perceived enemies. Exemplifying this bullying attitude was a letter initiated by Texas Senator Ted Cruz and signed by nine fellow Republicans, among them Florida's Marco Rubio and Arkansas's Tom Cotton. They write, "We urge you to comply with all American sanctions, but also to emphasize we would consider it particularly troubling if you sought to evade or undermine American statutes," stated the senator's letter. First, they wrote, "These statutes align with your government's commitment to deepen cooperation addressing Iran's ballistic missile program and destabilizing activities. Second, they were passed over several years by overwhelming bipartisan majorities, including in some cases via unanimous Senate passage, and Congress is obligated to ensure their implementation. Any attempt to evade or undermine them," the letter warns, "could well prompt congressional action in coordination with other elements of the U.S. government to ensure their integrity," end quote. The remainder of the letter continues in the same vein and demonstrates the utter contempt of the American political class for its European counterparts. And I suspect the only reason no Democrat senators signed the letter is that none were asked. What it does make clear is that Europe must choose between the United States and Iran. Despite a series of meetings with senior Iranian officials to discuss tactics for evading new American sanctions, and despite a joint statement issued Monday by the foreign ministers of Britain, France, Germany, and the European Union to, quote, "protect European economic operators engaged in legitimate business with Iran," end quote, it seems inevitable that they will give in when the alternative is to lose access to the far greater U.S. economy. According to yesterday's New York Times, more than 100 businesses had already announced their intent to leave Iran ahead of the sanctions. The most critical blow for Iran from Monday's sanctions was the previously announced cancellation by Boeing of an unprecedented $16.6 billion deal to upgrade Iran's aged and tattered passenger airline that hasn't had a new plane since 1979 due to past U.S. sanctions. A full range of sanctions, including Iran's sales of crude oil, are slated to be put back in place by November 4th, with a range of new ones expected early this month. Among their targets will be the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, or SWIFT. You may not have heard of it, but it's a major provider of global financial services. American and Europe's SWIFT have reportedly been told that they, too, will not be spared from new sanctions if they continue to facilitate business with Iran. Quote, "There's no question the banks represented on the board of SWIFT are in serious jeopardy, both the American banks and the foreign ones," said Richard Goldberg, a senior advisor to the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a pro-Israel lobbying operation and successor to the Project for New American Century that curiously was founded on the day after 9/11. Goldberg, a former senior Senate aide, was one of the architects of the initial SWIFT sanctions on Iran in early 2012. "Congress authorized the president to take a wide range of actions," he says, "against directors personally and against their financial institution employers. The Trump administration understands how crucial it is to sever Iran from SWIFT," said Goldberg, "so you can bet they will seek maximum enforcement of the sanctions." End quote. Diplomatic warnings to SWIFT directors not to challenge U.S. sanctions have reportedly already been issued. Such is the latest episode of the U.S. against the world. For most intents and purposes, the U.S. has declared war on Iran with the intent of overthrowing its government. Will any of those who have been complaining about Russia's alleged interference in U.S. politics acknowledge Washington's far greater transgressions against Iran? Not likely. By squeezing Iran's economy, Washington hopes to drive its citizenry into the streets, as has happened these past few days, protesting the collapsing economy and depreciation of the rial. Iran's currency, thanks to these new sanctions. The U.S. is particularly interested in reaching those Iranians who supported President Rouhani, expecting economic benefits to flow following the lifting of sanctions after Iran signed the agreement halting Iran's nuclear enrichment program for at least a decade, which President Trump ripped apart. Those sanctions have been implemented due, in a large part, to the pressures by Israel lobby in the U.S., particularly AIPAC, and the sister organizations in Britain, France, and Germany. You've heard me on numerous occasions speaking of AIPAC's outsized and pernicious influence over Congress, but their French and British counterparts are no slouches when it comes to making demands of their respective parliaments. In Britain, each party has its own pro-Israel caucus. Thus, there is the Labour Friends of Israel, the Conservative Friends of Israel, and the Liberal Democrat Friends of Israel, and, as if that was not sufficient, there is the all-party Britain-Israel parliamentary group, which brings them all together, not for Britain, but for Israel. This should be considered quite extraordinary when one considers that among Britain's population of 65 million, there are less than 300,000 Jews, not all of whom are on the same page when it comes to Israel. That they represent at best 1/250th of the British population has not stopped the Jewish Board of Deputies from waging a nonstop campaign against Labour Party leader and his likely candidate for Prime Minister, Jeremy Corbyn, claiming he is surrounded by anti-Semites and is soft in anti-Semitism, with one British Jewish leader declaring that the election of Corbyn, a longtime supporter of Palestinian rights, would be, quote, an existential threat to the Jews of Britain, end quote. In an unsuccessful effort to defuse these attacks, Corbyn submitted to an interview that was more of an inquisition by a reporter for a London Jewish paper, a third his age. He purged alleged anti-Semites from the party and renounced his earlier support for a German Holocaust survivor who had compared Israel's treatment of the Palestinians to the Nazis' treatment of the Jews. The latest attack came last weekend when the Board of Deputies rejected a proposal by Corbyn to adopt 3 out of 4 internationally accepted definitions of anti-Semitism that had been omitted by the Labour Party's new guidelines on the issue last month. According to a report in the Jewish News, Corbyn is considering adopting 3 of the definitions following a massive backlash against him and the Labour Party from the British Jewish community, the British media, and Labour moderates. The 3 definitions of anti-Semitism that the party has accepted are, 1, the allegation that Jews are more loyal to Israel than their country of citizenship, comparisons of contemporary Israeli society to that of the Nazis, and applying double standards to Israeli policy and actions that are not expected of other countries. The 1 International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, definition that is reported not being considered for adoption by Labour is a claim that, quote, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, that is, by claiming that the existence of Israel is a racist, the state of Israel is a racist endeavor, end quote. In response to the report, the Board of Deputies issued a statement on Twitter saying that, quote, we won't accept a watered-down definition designed to let anti-Semites off the hook, and pointed out that the IHRA definitions specifically state that, quote, criticism of Israel similar to that leveled against any other country cannot be regarded as anti-Semitic, end quote. In a column by Corbyn published by The Guardian on Friday, the Labour Party leader specifically said the definition describing Israel as a racist endeavor being anti-Semitic is what bothered him. I acknowledge, he said, that most of the Jewish community, including many Labour supporters, take a different view. The community, he said, should have been consulted more extensively at an earlier stage, which is why our executive has decided last month to reopen the development of the code in consultation with Jewish community organizations and others to address their concerns, end quote. The closest Corbyn came to criticism of Israel was his noting that, quote, this has been a difficult year in the Middle East, with the killing of many unarmed Palestinian protesters in Gaza, and Israel's new nation-state law relegating Palestinian citizens of Israel to second-class status. I know, he wrote, that many within the Jewish community, including the Board of Deputies, share our concerns. End quote. Meanwhile, further allegations of anti-Semitism were made against Corbyn by the Daily Mail on Sunday, the Sunday Mail, which said that the labor leader referred to a Jewish member of parliament, Louise Elman, in private as, quote, the honorable member for Tel Aviv, end quote, ostensibly accusing her of representing Israel instead of her constituents in the House of Commons. A spokesman for labor strongly denied the allegation. But the attacks on Corbyn are certain to continue up until the election. This has been Jeff Blankford, hoping you all stay safe. Thanks for listening.